look at gun violence and gun control. So far this year, two people in Wisconsin have died in gun-related murders. Today, Wisconsin Public Radio launches an ongoing series on gun murders in the state, tracking where and why they occur and following law enforcement and community groups' efforts to try and prevent them. Gilman Halstead has our first report.
The first gun murder of the year took place at the Sidetracked Bar in Wausau on January 3rd. According to police reports, the victim, 27-year-old Casey Christopher Elliott, was fighting in the bar parking lot with the suspect, 30-year-old John Lewis, when he was shot by what police believe was a .22-caliber semi-automatic handgun. The gun has not been recovered. Police say the two men knew each other and the suspect has served prison time for drug trafficking crimes. According to Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, the apparent cause of this gun death fits the typical profile for gun murders in Milwaukee, where 85 people were shot to death last year.
Many of these things are just arguments and fights among two people who are both carrying firearms, and somebody pulls a gun, and we have a dead person.
Milwaukee police are now investigating the first shooting death of the year in that city, the second in the state. A 20-year-old man was killed on Wednesday on the city's south side. Yesterday, police arrested an 18-year-old suspect in that murder. In 2012, the last year for which statewide figures are available, two-thirds of the 166 murders in the state involved a gun. 61% of the perpetrators were between the age of 18 and 34, as were 48% of the victims. And Mallory O'Brien of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission says usually both the victim and the suspect have a criminal record.
For 2013, looking at the victims and suspects of homicide, 76% of the victims have an arrest history and 93% of the suspects have an arrest history.
That's a small consolation to the families of the victims and to the people who live in the neighborhoods where the murders happen. Betty, who gave only her first name, lives on the block where Wednesday's Southside Milwaukee murder took place.
Crimes is always everywhere in the Southside. I think they should put like cameras in each block and have more cops, I guess, driving around.
Milwaukee police have used cameras to deter shootings in some city taverns where several gun crimes have occurred. But this week, the city got funds from the state to expand the use of microphones to record the sound of gunshots in crime-prone neighborhoods. Chief Flynn says the ShotSpotter technology is already helping police solve a problem that has hampered investigations in the past.
The data produced by the ShotSpotter technology told us an alarming truth. In some of our neighborhoods, the most gunfire-afflicted neighborhoods particularly, only 14% of the shots fired incidents were being called into 911.
Technology like this is one way police are trying to reduce gun deaths. On the legislative front, a bill designed to reduce the number of domestic violence gun deaths could get a vote before the end of the year. According to Tony Gibbert of End Domestic Violence Wisconsin, a preliminary report for last year found guns were used in 19 domestic violence murders. He says the new law would require courts to verify that anyone with a domestic violence restraining order immediately surrender any guns they own.
We know that some counties are starting to do this, but most counties do not have any kind of active enforcement procedure in place. And we do see throughout the years homicides that seemingly could have been prevented had there been more active enforcement.
Gibbard says that bill has not been scheduled for a vote yet. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we take a look at the national debate over gun control. Despite numerous mass shootings in the past few years, both sides of the debate have been unable to establish a productive dialogue about gun control in the country.
And our next guest wonders if maybe it's time to shift the way we frame the debate, trying a technique used in international conflict resolution that focuses on shared human values or sacred human values.
Joining us now is Tim Phillips. He's co-founder of Beyond Conflict, an international organization that advocates for peace and reconciliation. He wrote a recent opinion piece for Global Post about it, and we've got a link to the article on the Central Time Facebook page. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So you've worked in war-torn countries to try and negotiate an end to conflict, places like Northern Ireland, the Balkans, South Africa. How does what you've done abroad apply to the gun control debate in America?
Well, thank you. It's interesting. I'm actually speaking to you from London, where I'm attending a meeting with some leaders from South Africa who had been former enemies and really played a key role in negotiating the end of apartheid. And we're meeting with some people from some of the Arab Spring countries and people from both the Shia and Sunni communities. And we've been doing this sort of work for 22 years, trying to bring together people where there's no trust, where there's been not just conflict, but violence between the communities, and trying to find a way to get them to talk to each other. And that's been our work for 20 years, and it's what we're struggling with today in places like in the Arab Spring.
So you said what you're trying to do is get them to talk to each other. How do you get them to do that when these the conflicts and the history of violence and pain is so deep?
Well, that's the essential question. And I often say that in the DNA of our organization is this recognition that there's this shared human experience. One of the things we often find when we brought in the early 90s the two principal negotiators who negotiated the end of apartheid to Belfast, a lot of the leaders in both the Protestant and Catholic side said, how can we learn from people in South Africa, never mind El Salvador or anywhere else? Our situation is unique. Nobody understands what we've been through, and the divisions are too deep. And yet, when they forget these sort of superficial distinctions between the South African experience and Northern Ireland experience, and I don't mean to say they're superficial, but when they hear these leaders talk about that they came from a culture where there was no tradition of compromise, where there was such hate, and where everybody wanted to feel that they were right and try to impose their view on the other community, that in the example of Northern Ireland, hearing that from leaders who ended apartheid just a year or two earlier had a real impact on them. It made them think, well, if they could do that there in a much bigger context, why can't we do this here?
So you're talking about people getting together and sharing stories, their history, but also about their culture and their beliefs and what, you know, you might take for granted in day-to-day life. It sounds like this falls under the category of stuff that you call sacred values. Can we talk about that term and what it means?
Yes. So because of the work over the last 20 years, one of the most difficult problems in whether it be in South Africa 20 years ago or even in Northern Ireland today is this notion of identity and narrative. You know, what gives really birth to people's view of the world? You know, what is the family they come out of or the community they come out of? What do they hold sacred to their core identities? And, you know, a peace process, as in Northern Ireland, may be very important in stopping the violence, but it doesn't really address the underlying sort of grievances or identities that may have given birth to it in the future or in the past. You know, issues of exclusion, issues of marginalization, or issues of just inequality. And so in trying to address those issues, we came to realize that there are certain things that are not negotiable. There are certain things that people hold dear to their very identity, that they're almost, and not just almost sacred, but are sacred to them and to their community. And as we struggled with trying to understand this, we came across some writing that was done in the 1990s by some social psychologists who defined this notion of sacred values. And as I said in that commentary, that, you know, sacred values are somewhat obvious to people. You know, if you're a parent about your young child, you know, protecting them is sacred to you. There's not even a question about doing that. Or if you're a deeply religious person, the principles of your religion are above compromise. Or if you're a deeply patriotic person, so there are those things that accord to one's sense of morality that they would never compromise on it. And what was interesting is in the 1990s, these psychologists were noticing that if somebody approached somebody who holds a sacred value by trying to, you know, bribe them with an economic payment or a regulatory approach or some trade-off, some material trade-off, that these people responded with moral outrage and more aggressively to that because they felt their core integrity was under threat. And what's interesting, in the last two or three years, some neuroscientists, particularly at Emory University, with the sort of evolution of neuroimaging technology, actually was able to demonstrate physically through brain scans and research that we actually process sacred values and considerations of them in different regions of the brain than more, let's say, material trade-offs. You know, whether or not you're going to sell your house, what price would you consider? But those are processed in the brain differently than if somebody's asking you to compromise a deeply felt religious belief or something that's really core to your identity.
Well, if you take a look at the gun debate and the sacred values that are involved here. You know, I don't know exactly what people would say, but I can imagine some people would say the right to bear arms is sacred to me, and it's important that I feel that I can protect my family. And somebody else might say it's important to me to have stricter gun control laws because I need to protect my family, and fewer guns means I think my family is safer. So how does naming those, what you call sacred values, help at all? Because at the end of the day, you said them aloud, but they still exist.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things we learned in the work over the last 20 years is that it's important for people to own their own narrative and identity. For whatever reason it was created, whether it was something they inherited as a family tradition or something they experienced in their life or the religion or nation they live in. These are things that individuals decide for themselves are sacred to them, and they don't really want to compromise over. And one of the great lessons that's been emerging in conflict resolution around the world is you have to both recognize that in another person and not try to tell that person who they are and what's right and what's wrong. And what we've seen is when people are recognized for having the value, that another person is validating it, they don't have to own it. They don't have to accept it. But they say, you know, I recognize this is sacred to you. I recognize this is important to you. And in doing so, the research and the experience shows that those people, because they're not being challenged to compromise their sacred value, literally start listening more. Doesn't mean you're trying to convince them to change their mind, but you get to a common ground where you can actually engage in a rational conversation. And because I've witnessed this over the years and currently trying to work on some of these approaches in some of the Arab Spring countries, as an American citizen who, you know, loves my country and cares deeply about it, when I see this sort of, you know, debate happening that's not on any rational ground, I thought, well, the same frame we use in international conflict, really, it's the human experience, really should be framed for this really important and increasing debate in the United States. And it's not to take a position. I mean, at one time, I used to teach rifle and shotgun at a camp when I was a teenager in my early 20s. I was a member of the NRA. So I'm not coming to this from a particular point of view or partisan point of view. I'm coming to this as somebody who has spent the last 25 years as an American trying to help people figure out on their own how to resolve their conflict.
We're talking right now with Tim Phillips about bringing the concept of sacred human values into the gun control debate, and we'd like to hear from you about this. Do you think this would help to articulate what it is that we think is sacred when it comes to guns and gun control? And do you think we could ever get this to work in Washington? Can you mix the emotional human value side of things with politics? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking now with Tim Phillips, who has worked with an international agency to affect reconciliation in war-torn places. And we're talking about how to apply the idea of voicing sacred values to the gun control debate in America. Our guest says that it could be just the thing we need to move things along in a place where there seems to be gridlock. And we want to know what you think is sacred surrounding guns and gun control. Maybe we can try a little bit of this on the air right now. And do you think that it's possible to take something like this, talking about sacred human values, and apply it to politics? Will we ever get anywhere with that? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, I want to ask you, when we're talking about sacred human values, for instance, it sounds like it's something that you might be discussing in a different setting. It's a little touchy-feely. It's the emotional landscape. It's the kind of stuff that people don't often volunteer freely, for instance. How will that ever be compatible with policymaking?
Well, that's a core question. I would say that, you know, over the last 6 months to a year, as I've seen the debate in the United States over gun control getting more and more vitriolic and more sort of divisive, I started thinking in terms of, well, to be honest, the approach that the administration or Mayor Bloomberg or other people have been taking doesn't recognize that for a lot of people, this may be a sacred value to them. And on the flip side, you know, for people who worry deeply about their children, and particularly the infants who were recently killed, that that may be a violation of their sacred value as well. And I thought, here are considerations that are deeply sacred to all sides, including people who, you know, view the Second Amendment as a very important sacred value. They also care deeply about their children. And it seemed to me that there was no recognition from both sides that these are sacred values for each side of the debate. And having applied the sacred value lens to some of the conflicts around the world, in finding that once people are allowed to own their own sacred value and nobody's trying to get them to compromise on it, they then start to engage rationally and say, okay, let's have a conversation and see if we can find common ground.
So it sounds
we
like,
weren't doing this in our country.
So it sounds like you're saying once you can let go of this fear response that someone's going to try to take from you what you hold dearest, you realize that's not going to happen, then you can actually talk things through.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where actually the neuroscience is interesting. They find that we cannot think rationally until we feel that our identities are understood and recognized by others. And that's actually biologically based. And so if a sacred value is so deeply sacred that it's by extension emotional, that until you feel safe that this sacred value of yours is being validated by others, doesn't mean the other side has to agree to it, but they recognize it. They say, yes, I understand this is sacred to you. I understand that this is important to you. And here's what's important to me. So if we can both respect that these things are important to us, then maybe we can have a conversation about finding common ground. And frankly, I don't see this happening on both sides in this debate. And until that happens, I don't think we can have a rational debate in this country about the Second Amendment, about gun control, safety, or whatever you want to call it. But that's a prerequisite in this country to have, I think, a very rational and considered discussion. And, you know, it's funny, we as Americans have been spending the last 20 years with all these transitions happening around the world, trying to help other countries reconcile. And one of the greatest insights is this recognition of what's sacred to people. And we haven't been applying it here.
Let's get our callers in on this. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll go first to Barry in Chicago. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, how about you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
What do you think about the idea of sharing sacred values?
Well, you know, I think it's a very valid point. Mr. Phillips points out something that I think, would apply to any mediation between two opposing parties. I would only add, my particular comment is that what I've seen in these debates, particularly in gun control, and for the record, I'm on the pro-gun side, pro-liberty side, I would say, it comes to mind that we don't fully recognize what those sacred values are. Whenever I hear someone speaking on pro-gun control and they speak to me, they don't recognize what I'm saying. In fact, they don't hear me. It seems like they don't hear me. So I think, and I'm probably the same way when I'm listening to others and I consider my values more important. I consider the value of my personal liberty more important.
Okay. Well, let's start with there because there's plenty to chew on. Thank you for that call, Barry. And Tim, what about people not feeling heard when they do express themselves and their sacred values?
Well, I think Barry made a very good point. And there's another consideration, which is of bias. And one of the things we've found, and there's been research, you know, through cognitive science with bias. And it turns out that when we are biased against what somebody's telling us, we actually hear less. And we're biased towards something we want to hear, we actually hear more. And I don't mean just this empirically, but biologically, they can see the neural activity in the brain that increases when we're hearing something that supports our point of view, and we actually hear less when it doesn't. And, you know, this is, to me, was a revelation in the last 2 years about sacred values. And once they started showing this sort of biological basis for it, it struck me that that was critical to this policy debate in the United States and many issues, which is you really have to understand how people come to their sense of identity, which is really about their sense of feeling safe in the world. And you need to be heard, and you need to be understood. And only then can you have a rational conversation.
Let's take one more quick call. Tom from Oshkosh, you're next.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Great. My question comes to the application of spiritual principles and identifying them at the front end of a conversation so that some sense of unity in coming to the question of gun control can be achieved before you even speak of gun control and the emotions that it brings out.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for being brief there. And we've only got a little bit of time for your answer, Tim. What about spirituality involved in all of this?
Well, I mean, it's really key. I mean, spirituality is obviously unique to every individual, but it has some ancient roots, and even, quite frankly, from the research I've done long before established religion, this notion of what is sacred really is based on our sense of community, of understanding the environment you live in, that their places became sacred because they gave us landmarks of security and identity, and over a period of time, that's evolved. And so, you know, I've said in this op-ed and also seen some of the response to it that this isn't to suggest an answer. This is to suggest a framework, which is to say you cannot have a conversation, whether it's about religious principles, somebody's sense of liberty and or safety on either side until you recognize that people have to own these identities.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Tim Phillips, co-founder of Beyond Conflict, an international organization that advocates for peace and reconciliation.